Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com. /awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
From Nice Guy Productions, world headquarters overlooking the glamorous San Fernando Valley, I'm Mick Garris, and this is the fun size edition of Postmortem AMA, where you can ask me anything. And asking your questions is producer Joe Russo. Joe, I was going to ask how you are, but I think you're a little under the weather today.
I am under the weather today, but because we love our postmortemers, here I am. We're doing the AMA right before you leave for England.
That's jolly, right.
Jolly yeah. old England.
And, jolly old.
And what are you doing in England, Mick? What should they be keeping their eyes and ears out for?
Well, I blush as I tell you that I'm the guest of honor at ChillerCon 2022. And I will be joined by Kim Newman and Grady Hendrix, among other estimable folks there. In Scarborough, UK. So it should be a lot of fun.
That sounds like a lot of fun. It appears that I've had a bout of food poisoning. And ironically, we were just talking, this is the second time I've had to host a postmortem under the auspices of food poisoning. Because the first time was my first ever appearance on the show, which was for Critters 2 when I interviewed you.
And you were moderating it, yeah.
I was moderating for you and Lin Shaye and the Kyoto brothers. And here we are. But the good news is that instance, we weren't going to be able to edit. This instance, we could. So
Just in case. Yeah, I mean, fortunately, In-N-Out Burgers is not a sponsor. So
no, but you were just telling me, though, because we think In-N-Out is the likely culprit, which is really sad because I do really like In-N-Out. But you did a jingle for them once?
I did a singing commercial for them back in the 70s. Huh. It was a ripoff of the Who song Squeeze Box. And it was stand up and shout for In-N-Out and In-N-Out and In-N-Out Burgers.
There so was go. This like, was this related to Horse Feathers or was this like
yes.
a one-off? Yes.
It was okay. related to Horse Feathers in that our keyboard player worked for the commercial production company that they were a client for. And so the guy hired us to do the singing commercial.
There you go. Who would have thought Mick Garris is part of the history of In-N-Out? So
yes. Southern California's own chain.
That's right.
Of
that's
burgers great. That I wouldn't eat in a million years now.
Not anymore. But they do have the grilled cheese, which is, you know, which is what my wife.
It's
is.
Dairy. It's dairy. I don't do animal products.
That's right. Yes. I'm not gonna say you're missing out because I clearly am in a lot of pain. So all right, Mick.
We better burn through these.
Should we dive into some questions then?
Yes, let's do it. Get it over for poor Joe.
Yes. All right. Well, this is a fresh one that just came in today, and I know you're going to love it when I ask it.
Uh-oh.
Lori wants to know, why won't you watch Top Gun?
Well, it is just entirely outside of my realm of interest.
Sure.
You know, it was produced at a time that it was very jingoistic and pro Reagan's America, which is something that I really had a problem with and still do to this day. And, you know, I'm patriotic, but not in that sense. You know,
I do have a question, because like, you're a big Tom Cruise fan, right? You like Tom
Cruise. I think he's very talented. Yeah.
Yes. So, I mean, I would say maybe at just some point you should consider it, because it is much more of a drama than it is just a rah-rah action movie.
I understand that, but everything it represents to me is something that's anathema to me. And I know that it's a movie that I'm not interested in seeing.
Just well, fair enough, movie. But you're missing a good one. So, all right.
I let you watch it so I don't have to.
Fair enough. So I guess you're not going to be in line for the sequel. All right. Krister writes, between Needful Things, Storm of the Century, and Randall Flagg in the Stand, Stephen King taps into the unknown threat, the omnipotent stranger, as catalyst for major upheaval, representing the worst of us. How do you think King's view on life, or a possible afterlife, reflect through these stories and characters?
Well, I can't speak for Stephen King, obviously, but, you know, nobody is more dangerous or mysterious than the unknown. And a character who represents the unknown certainly is important. But King is a believer. He's not a born-again Christian, but he is a Christian. And he knows the Bible very well. And it's also a part of being in AA, is a belief in a higher power.
Right.
It's certainly a part of his life. So all of the parables told within those stories, particularly in The Stand, have antecedents in biblical stories. And so I think the afterlife is very much a part of those beliefs. So again, I don't share those beliefs particularly, but, and I can't speak for Stephen King, but I can speak for having taken a creative position on translating those works to film. And so that would be my interpretation of his approach.
When you do have to adapt something where you don't necessarily share the same religious or socio-political beliefs as the author of the book being adapted, I mean, how do you position that yourself? Like, do you try and open up the empathy to understand where they're coming from? How do you get into that mode?
Yeah, I'm a storyteller, and I'm an author as well, a screenwriter as well. And I don't believe in ghosts, but I certainly tell ghost stories all the time. Right. And you put yourself in a situation with any fictional story of, what if this is true? What if this happens? And they're always fictional, but they always have to feel genuine. So you ground those characters and those beliefs and those ideas in something that's very earthbound to make it feel real, and to share an empathy with every character's point of view, rather than easily delineating good versus evil. You want to depict all the shades of gray of all the characters. And so you do become a believer from the point of view of a story being told. There are some that I don't want to be a believer in that point of view, and, you know, have turned down some things that philosophically I was not interested in portraying.
There you have it. Speaking of The Stand, I got a question from my writing partner, Chris Lamont.
Oh, Chris, yeah.
Yeah, and he wants to know, the Don't Fear the Reaper opening to The Stand is one of the most memorable sequences I can think of. How did you conceive it? How much of it was in the script, and how long did it take to shoot?
First of all, thank you. There was a lot of work put into it. The song was put in, it was in the script. And just the idea that we travel down the corridors of this underground facility, military facility, as it plays in the background. And that was about it. And then it was really just plotting out each of the steps of that, and taking the Steadicam and using that as a tool that gives you a drifty, almost dreamlike quality, which we further emphasized by shooting in high speed so it would play back in slow motion. So there was a very dreamlike, ghostly quality to the deaths that were laid out for us one after another, and decided to make it the credit sequence and extend it to be able to carry the weight of all of the credits. And it timed out really nicely. And it was such a perfect musical choice that it made the song into a hit single all over again.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it is. It is iconic for sure. And as is my writing partner finally making an appearance on Postmortem.
Yay, Chris Lamont.
Yay, Chris Lamont. All right. Woody Woodpickle writes.
Oh, another Woody Woodpickle.
That's right. He is a good fan. He's a good Postmortemer.
Becoming a regular. Yeah.
That's right. I saw an old interview you did with Harlan Ellison on YouTube.
Yeah.
Both of your personalities couldn't be further apart, which made me wonder, how did you guys get along off air? Bonus question for you and Joe. What Harlan story would you want to adapt?
You know, we got along really well. Harlan was a very cynical guy, and he told bullshit stories all the time as if they were true. You know, he was so smart and so entertaining. You'd never want to get into an argument with Harlan Ellison, because he would shred you to pieces and take great delight in doing it. But Harlan was one of a kind, and you know, he hated the term sci-fi, even though a lot of his career was science fiction that he'd written.
Right.
But, you know, there were, he was a brilliant guy and a very entertaining guy. And, you know, I know Josh Olson and he were very close before he passed, but
right.
Harlan was a great guest. And yeah, we had very different styles. He could take you or leave you. And that's not how I operate my life, but no, we got along great. We were friends.
That's great. That's good to hear. So even off camera, even if it might've been combative on camera, off camera,
he was combative off camera as well.
Not true.
But that was part of his personality.
Absolutely. What about, is there any of his works that ever, you know, tickled your fancy, do you think?
Well, I loved a lot of his works, but a lot of them were too short to really adapt into a full-length film. I mean,
right.
A Boy and His Dog was done beautifully.
Yeah.
But mostly, you know, that was Blood's a Rover was the associated story.
Yeah.
But I love the collection I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream. That might be my favorite collection of his works, other than his essays that he wrote for the LA Weekly. But I'd never thought of adapting any of his works, because so many of, like Richard Christian Matheson, writes really short stories,
right?
As well as the occasional novel. But Harlan's works were very self-contained and very internal. So I know that there was one of them adapted for Masters of Science Fiction, adapted by Josh Olson. I wasn't really involved in that
right
series that was stolen from my series.
Yeah, we've touched on that before. I think for me, if I was going to touch anything of his work, it would be trying to remake A Boy and His Dog. I've always loved that movie, and you know, I as you know, I'm a big dog person. So
you and me both. Yeah.
Yep. Can relate on a lot of levels with that one. Avery wants to know, what do you do if you feel doubt in a project or your directing abilities?
You get over it. You know, if you don't feel up to it, then maybe it's not the job for you. But the thing is, if you are a director, you need the confidence to convince everybody around you that your vision is worth expressing. And, you know, you need confidence and strength to be able to pull together a cast and crew and make something meaningful out of that. The doubting has to come well before pre-production.
Yeah.
You know, and if you are doubting, I don't know, see a therapist or change jobs. Because it requires confidence, not blind confidence, but maybe it's the material you're feeling doubts about. But if you're feeling personal doubts about your work, then it's time to look inside and see, why am I doubting this? What am I afraid of? What am I not good enough at? And then put some thought into how to improve that. Is it cinematographically? Is it that you're not sure how to express something through camera? Then work with a great cinematographer who understands you. Is it a cast, dealing with cast? That's something that's really important, to be able to convey and communicate with cast. And every level of filmmaking is based on communication. And as the director, you have to be seen as knowledgeable and confident in your vision. Right. Because if people can talk you out of your vision, then what are you doing there?
Yeah, no, I agree. There's a really great podcast. I hate to refer people to other podcasts, but hey,
I'm happy to.
Yeah, happy to. Called Script Notes with John August and Craig Mazin. And I mean, maybe a little bit more applicable to writing, but there was an episode in their vault, and they've reaired it a couple times, where they brought on a therapist to talk about creatives going to therapy and the benefits of therapy, and kind of working through those doubts and basically trying to normalize it. It's a really great listen. And I would definitely recommend that Avery go and seek it out. I think it's in their back catalog, so it might cost like $5 for the month or something like that. But really great episode. And this is like, this guy is like the Hollywood creative therapist. He was a screenwriter himself. And then he decided.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He used to write for the Writers Guild magazine every issue.
Yes. Yes. You know who I'm talking about. I wish I knew.
Dennis, I forget his last name.
Yeah. But worth checking out. I think, you know, there's a lot.
Dennis Palumbo.
Yes, that is it. Yeah.
Dennis Palumbo.
Yes. So anyway, check out that interview with him. It's terrific. You know, and if those doubts are, you know, continuing to creep beyond that, maybe even schedule an appointment. Sometimes it can help to chat with creatives directly, but I think mixed advice is sound. Kind of staying on that train of thought, S.M. Reviews asks, while in production, how do you handle it when a scene doesn't go as planned?
Well, they often don't go as planned for a number of reasons, whether it's weather or an actor having a different take that wasn't what you discussed, or special effects not being ready or appropriate or whatever. You roll with the punches, and often it will come out better than what you'd planned. But I know you're talking about when things go wrong, and you just have to make the most of it. Maybe you can do it over. I'll give you an example. When we were shooting The Stand, there's a very, very touching scene where Mother Abigail is about to leave her home for the last time with the group. And all of her belongings are roped into an old pickup truck. And Ruby Dee, who was a fantastic, fantastic actress, one of the goddesses of theater, television, and film. We're doing the rehearsal, and I can see it's giving it all. And she's giving everything to it. There are tears. And I said, please, save it for the take. Save it for the take. But she was such a committed actress that even in the run-through, she was giving it her all.
Yeah.
And the tears were pouring, and it was heartrending and fantastic. But by the time I called action for the first take, she'd used it up. The tears were dry. She wasn't there, and she knew it.
Yeah.
And because it was a 100-day shoot, there were a couple of things where we had to roll with the punches. And I said, look, this isn't working. I know Ruby, she knew it. She said, it's not working. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I said, we're going to come back and do it tomorrow. And we filled the day with other work that we could do that we weren't planning for that day. And then we did it again, and it was fantastic. It was everything that she had given to the rehearsal the day before, but she had a day to reboot, and it worked out well. So you have to try to make lemonade out of lemons.
Yeah, yeah. And honestly, that's a great example of the dangers of rehearsal sometimes, you know?
Yeah, rehearsal can be your best friend or your worst enemy.
Yeah, yep, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of people who are split on that. I believe like Spielberg...
He never rehearses.
Never rehearses, yeah. He wants to get that authenticity. Ridley Scott is very much the same. And then there's other directors who rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it, you know?
I remember going to a DGA panel of all the nominated directors for the Directors Guild Awards years ago. And it was Spielberg and Cameron and James L. Brooks, and I forget who else. And Spielberg was talking about not giving his actors rehearsal and direction beforehand. And James L. Brooks was just watching aghast because he said, what's the director's job then? Because he could not imagine such a thing, but just different filmmakers work in different ways to achieve their goals.
Absolutely. And that is the trick about directing, is there's really no one way to do it. And our final question for today is from Ryan, who asks, what's the origin story of the Postmortem podcast? A lot of us longtime listeners can piece together bits and pieces, but I'd be curious to hear about its inception.
Well, the very beginning of Postmortem was as a television show for FearNet. Peter Block had come to me and talked about the idea of doing this interview series for FearNet, which he was the program director for while he was still at Lionsgate. And so we did 10 interviews, television interviews, under the title Postmortem. And it included Carpenter and Hooper and Wes Craven and William Friedkin and Rick Baker. And, you know, we had 10 of the great names in our genre. And that's all it ever was going to be. And then FearNet kind of disappeared. It went under. And when you, Joe, met with your friend who worked at Podcast One and pitched the idea of it, when we had our meeting with the Mucky Mucks there, they loved using the title because it was an existing title that already had some familiarity. And even though it was a few years later, we decided to use that and run with it.
Yeah. Yeah. We dug it back up. It was funny. It was, right in the middle of us, selling and getting ready to, start prepping Nightmare Cinema.
Yeah.
And I just happened to have an encounter with a guy at a party who worked at Podcast One. And, you know, I on a lark said, you know, the producer I'm partnered with on this anthology used to do a interview series. And it happened really fast. I mean, that was probably in the fall. And then our first episodes were recorded, you know, that following January and released, I think that following February.
And now here we are in year six.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. And still going strong, even when I'm sick. So
that's right. And speaking of which, I think we'd better wrap it up so you can get some time off here.
Yes, I will do it. Have a lovely trip across the pond.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone for your questions and just for being listeners and supporting the show. Joe, tell them how they can ask their questions.
You can send future questions for Ask Mick Anythings to Mick at Mick Garris PM on Twitter and Instagram, or you can send them to me at Joe Russo Tweets and at Joe Russo Graham on Twitter and Instagram, respectively.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Feel better.
Thanks, Mick.
Thank you for listening to Postmortem with Mick Garris. Download new episodes every Wednesday and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.